Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why does Greg Abbott want to be governor of Texas, and what sort of leadership would he provide if he is able to win first the Republican nomination and then the general election 13 months from now? Abbott has had a great run so far in his career, having served on the Texas Supreme Court before an easy victory placed him in office as state attorney general in 2002. His nascent run for governor is already so well-funded that it appears he will have little competition in the GOP primary, which causes Texas Monthly magazine to only half-jokingly refer to him on its October cover as the Gov, barring an unlikely occurrence. Senior executive editor Brian Sweeney wrote the profile of Abbott entitled The Overcomer. Brian, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So you open this piece with the scene of Abbott and some old friends spending the day shooting clay pigeons, which is perhaps not a surprising pastime for any Texan who aspires to statewide office. But you say not only was his endurance impossible to overlook, it may be that by that endurance, he is looking to prove something.
I think that's true. He tries to get together with many of his friends from Duncanville High School once a year. One of his friends has this terrific piece of property not too far from Glen Rose, and they go out and they hunt and they fish and they do a little bit of shooting. And I was fortunate enough to be invited along for this and spent the afternoon with him and his friends. And one of the things that struck me was, one, that he is a pretty good shot and grew up around guns and is comfortable with guns. But as you say, you know, no Texas politician ever went wrong being photographed with guns or making that part of their story. We did a great cover that I remember back in April of 1994 with Governor Ann Richards,
sure.
And she had gone hunting with some folks in a small town, and we had this great photograph of her with shotguns. And so I think that is not unexpected. What's interesting with him is because he is in the wheelchair, I think that there is also an aspect of this type of scene that shows that despite everything else and what he has overcome, that he is just as vigorous and he is just as tough as any other candidate that he might have to face down. And that was one of the things that really struck me about being out there that day.
Did you sense at all that the 90-minute shooting marathon was for your benefit or your photographers, or this is just the way he is in general to show that he is just as vigorous as anyone else?
Well, I think that it was for everyone's mutual benefit is probably a good way to say it. I mean, obviously that I had put in requests to spend some time with him. This was a great opportunity. This was something that, as I say, he and his friends do. It is part of the story that he has tried to tell. But I think also that there's no question that there was a level of wanting to communicate this to Texans and to Texas voters. At his announcement speech in San Antonio, for example, before he came out on stage, there were doing various activities, and his 16-year-old daughter Audrey came out on stage, and the gentleman who was there hosting it asked her, "What is your favorite thing to do with your dad?" And her first reply was hunting, which I think probably surprised a lot of people, but I think goes toward this narrative that he is trying to build. And he told me stories that when he was growing up in Longview, you know, the first time that he had fired a .22 and the first time that he had gone out and fired a shotgun. But again, this is Texas. Guns and Second Amendment rights are a major issue, particularly on the Republican side of things, and particularly coming into a Republican primary where voters are going to be more conservative and I think are going to be focused on issues like that. And I think that General Abbott is going to make sure that people know that this is something that he believes in strongly.
He was just 26 when his spinal cord was damaged irreparably by a falling tree. How candid is he about the memories he has of time spent in recovery and then learning to adapt to life as a paraplegic?
This is one of the things I think that is really, really striking about his life story. And for me, for two reasons. One is that for a long time, we actually didn't know a lot about the details of the accident. And so for the listeners who maybe don't know, he was in River Oaks. He was had graduated from law school. He was actually studying for the bar exam with a friend of his. He had already had a job offer from Butler and Binion in Houston. And so after studying, he had gone jogging with his friend Fred Frost. And about 5 minutes into the jog, this unbelievable accident happened. A massive oak tree snapped and fell and knocked him to the ground. And as you say, caused unbelievable damage. It crushed vertebrae in his spine, terrible internal injuries, and was near death. You went from somebody who was a star athlete in high school for track, somebody who was an avid runner, to then being confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. And I think that this was something that people knew that this had happened, but they weren't sure of the details. And for us to hear it, to hear how unbelievably traumatic the medical experience was, he was actually transported to a facility, and doctors didn't know what to do with him initially. He wasn't taken to Herman, which is where he probably should have been, which was would be able to handle traumas like this. So he was actually held for a while without getting the adequate treatment that he needed before they finally put him back in an ambulance and then sent him over to a better hospital to take care of him. And when doctors got to him there, he was near death. And in fact, the first procedure that they did, according to General Abbott, they did without administering anesthesia. And the nurse took his hand and held him and told him, "This is going to be bad," as they began to try to save his life. Hmm. What's happened now, and one of the things that's interesting, having had the opportunity to spend time with him, is how unbelievably open and frank he is about it. Not just him, but his family as well. They make jokes about it. He will make jokes about the accident itself. For example, I was at an event with him in Wichita Falls where, as he was telling this, and this is a powerful part of his biography, it is a cornerstone of his campaign, having overcome this thing, that he said, you know, "Well, you all are probably wondering, how slow is that guy jogging to be hit by the tree?" But the story itself is incredibly powerful, and it's very moving to hear it, and to see then what he has overcome since that time. And I think that's the real narrative of his life. He was interested in politics prior to the accident. He was a talented student, had done very, very well at the University of Texas and at Vanderbilt Law. He was certainly on his way. I don't know that politics was the path that was before him, but I think once he began to reassess who he was and what he wanted to do after the accident, politics was something that was in the offing.
Brian, Greg Abbott's critics have argued that had the tort reform that he championed been in place when he was injured, that he would not have received the kind of settlement he did. What did you learn about the veracity of those claims?
That's a terrific question. And it's a terrific question because it taps into something that I had mentioned earlier, which is that even though people knew that General Abbott was in a wheelchair and they knew that there had been this accident, there were a lot of stories flying around, in part because he hadn't addressed it directly. Part of that was because he had received a settlement from the homeowner and from the tree company that was supposed to service the tree that had not identified it as rotting. And what ended up happening is that there was a settlement in which he received or will receive over the lifetime of the settlement roughly $11 million. And, you know, like a lot of these settlements, he received an immediate payment of $300,000. He received monthly payments of $5,000 that are adjusted annually. And he receives intermittent payments. On November 1, for example, he'll receive a lump sum payment of $400,000. And so what this did was it allowed his critics to tap into this notion that General Abbott was a hypocrite, because in fact, here was this tort reform movement that was kicking up in Texas. Remember, back in 1994, it was one of the things that George W. Bush had run on as one of his key areas that he wanted to focus on as governor. A little bit happened in the 90s, not as much, in part because the Senate and the House at that time were controlled by Democrats. In fact, Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock at the time was the one who was able to sort of keep a lid on the types of reforms that had come through. The big session for tort reform was 2003. That was the first session in which Republicans had the governor's mansion, the Senate, and the House. And there were a lot of major changes that came through, including on medical malpractice, that General Abbott supported. So this gave rise to this. He did finally release his the terms of his settlement, came out after he made his announcement in July. And so I contacted somebody that many of your viewers are going to be familiar with, William Bresenio, who is a law professor at SMU. And I asked him about this. And what he said was, on one hand, and I sort of chuckled at this, he doesn't agree with all of General Abbott's opinions related to tort reform. And so he wanted to make that clear. But that looking at his case and what had happened in the 80s versus the case that if it had happened today, what a person might be able to claim, he actually believed that the mechanisms in place were very, very similar, which is to say, I guess, in sort of shorthand, that if an accident like this were to happen today, somebody would be able to receive or have the opportunity to receive these types of damages. The one change that he saw, that Professor Desenio saw, was that because the environment now has shifted far more in favor of insurance companies and away from plaintiffs, that an insurance company may be less likely to settle. They may believe that they could get favorable terms or actually win the case if they went to trial, which back in the 80s, there was just this sense that the insurance companies were not going to win and it was better for them to settle. But I think this will continue to be an issue. For example, early on in General Abbott's career as Attorney General, he actually moved against one component of the Americans with Disabilities Act, saying that it was unconstitutional, which a lot of people were thinking, well, how on earth could somebody who has suffered through this and is in a wheelchair make the argument that there is a portion of the ADA that is unconstitutional? But in fact, that's exactly what he did. And I think that critics will sort of continue with that line of question, that line of attack. My sense from my reporting was that if you compare these things as apples to apples to the degree that you can, it probably does come out ultimately in his favor.
What sort of campaigner is he? What sort of presence does he have on the stump and then meeting with people on an individual basis?
Well, I'll go back to what I had said about the wheelchair. I think that we have not seen this in a long time. And, you know, we have politicians like Tammy Duckworth, for example, and we had Max Cleland, who was a former senator from Georgia. But to see individuals in wheelchairs at this level is a rare occurrence. And so one of the things that I think that he has to negotiate is people's comfort level with that. I was at the event in Duncanville, for example, that was held in Ben Franklin's Apothecary. And so there was no stage set up there, and it was in the cafe area, and there was a big crowd in a small space. And there were people in the back who couldn't see. And I actually heard one person say, you know, I can't see him. Why can't I see him? Why isn't he up on a stage? And at these events, I noticed that there are actually some people who didn't realize that he's in a wheelchair. And so it creates an issue there. But I think that, as I had mentioned, they've worked very, very hard to not only make people comfortable with it, but to sort of laugh about it. At that same event, his daughter Audrey had said that the wheelchair allowed him to dress up in some outrageous Halloween costumes, for example, as a grocery cart or an army tank. That gets a big laugh. And I had a breakfast with his wife, Cecilia, whom they've been married for a very, very long time, were married in the early 80s, had met at UT as students, and had gotten hitched before they went off to law school in Tennessee. And, you know, she was saying that how grateful she was for the support that her husband had received after the accident, and that once he saw that there were no limitations on where he could go, he just ran with it, she told me. And then there was a pause, and then she looked at me and smiled and said, or he rolled with it. And so there is this sense that they are trying to literally steer into the curve of the disability and the wheelchair so that people are comfortable with it. And by getting comfortable with it, then they become comfortable with him as a candidate. He is a very warm man. When you talk with him, one of the things that I noticed, he is excellent at the retail aspect of politics, which is to say, he looks you in the eye. He seems genuinely interested in what you're asking and what information you're trying to get from him. He doesn't seem to gloss over, you know, from one constituent to the next. But it is true, I think, that the wheelchair does create a level of space, and that's something that he'll have to negotiate going forward, that it puts people at a bit of a distance.
Brian Sweeney is with us. He is senior executive editor for Texas Monthly Magazine, speaking today from the studios of KUT in Austin. He wrote Texas Monthly's cover story about Attorney General Greg Abbott. It's called The Overcomer. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses. smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to Texas Monthly Magazine's senior executive editor, Brian Sweeney. He wrote the October cover story about Attorney General Greg Abbott. It's called The Overcomer. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Okay, Brian, Attorney General is a very important position in our state and any other, but it is not necessarily guaranteed to bring you great fame. How well known are Greg Abbott's achievements, and are Texans in general inclined to think favorably about it?
That's an excellent question. One of the things that I very much enjoyed about reporting this story was the different people that I was able to visit with. And so one of the very first phone calls that I made was to Governor Mark White, a Democrat, who is the last person who has gone directly from being Attorney General to the governor's mansion in the 80s. And I asked him not for political comment on the story or on General Abbott, but just more one of a process comment. And what he had said was, you know, for a long time, the Attorney General's office was actually not much of a step to anywhere, but that had changed. And it had changed as the Attorney General's office had become more aggressive. And so, for example, suits that he had been able to work on, keep in mind that John Cornyn, our senior U.S. senator, was Attorney General previous to leaving for D.C. And so I think one of the things that General Abbott has been able to do, as Governor White had said, was that when you are pursuing various suits, you're able to make it sound as if you are doing this for the state of Texas, and by God, I'm protecting the rights of Texans, and then that's often a very popular way for you to get into the newspapers and the headlines. And so there are a number of things. For example, the fugitive unit that they set up that was rounding up people who were in violation of their parole, who had committed sex crimes, crimes against children, and things like that, has gotten a number of criminals off of the streets. That had the Attorney General's office not put resources behind it, that would not have happened. And as he told me in the story, it's difficult to know how many crimes that we have prevented as a result of something like that. But even that sort of initiative doesn't get headlines the way suing to prevent the removal of a Ten Commandments monument at the Capitol does, which he did and did successfully, and that monument is still there. Certainly all of the suits that he has filed against the federal government as of late, you know, he says on the campaign trail, I didn't invent the phrase, don't mess with Texas, but I've applied it more than anybody else. And he brags about this, that he has sued the federal government, you know, coming up on 30 times now, from everything to perceived federal overreach with environmental regulations to certainly that big thing, Obamacare. And there's another angle where I think that no Republican in Texas is going to go wrong by lacing into the Barack Obama administration and Democrats at large by saying that they're impinging on our gun rights, they're impinging on our privacy rights. Federal government wants to know every aspect of your of what you're doing and control it, and I'm here to stop that. And I think that that's a powerful message for Republican primary voters in particular, and I think that he's very aware of that. I think that what he has worked hard to do since he has become Attorney General is position himself in that way. That's not to suggest that he doesn't believe that these suits are the right thing. I have no doubt that he does. But when you look at what he has, what type of legislation, what types of suits that he has pursued, I think it's very clear that it develops this narrative that he is, in fact, a conservative's conservative.
Did that all begin, Brian, that spate of actions against the federal government, did that begin in 2009 when the Obama administration walked into office?
Well, I think that you had the suit against the American Disabilities Act. That was one of the early parts of his tenure. Obviously, at that point, George W. Bush was president, and so that might complicate the narrative. But certainly, since President Obama has taken office, that has become a fairly easy target, and one that, as I say, has become Republicans, you know, sort of favorite and most reliable pinata. It works. I mean, the fact of the matter is that these suits work, whether he wins them or he doesn't win them. And I think that going forward, that's going to be one of the strong things that he's going to try to run on. Now, we've heard the news today that this antitrust suit with American Airlines, for example, something that originally that Greg Abbott had supported with the federal government with Eric Holder. And so that was sort of a weird position after all of these suits where they're sort of at each other's throats. Now we hear today that, in fact, there's a press conference later on in which we think that General Abbott is going to reverse course on that and perhaps, you know, make the case that Texas is not going to be party to that suit. There's obviously a political aspect to all of these things, while at the same time there is a practical aspect where, you know, the attorney general has to go out and do the job and execute the duties of the office.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Martin in Fort Worth. Hi, Martin.
Yes, hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Be your guest. You know, I was injured in an automobile accident in 1987, and it was really bad. I had lots of internal injuries. I'm an L2-3 paraplegic, and so it's been 26 years now. And there are hundreds of thousands of people like me in the state of Texas. People come from all over the nation to move to Texas who are in wheelchairs because we have a flat terrain largely, and we have lots of concrete, and so we're very accessible. We don't have a lot of bad weather. People from, you know, Buffalo, New York, people from all over the place move
here.
That's
interesting.
And we mostly, most of us have to work. And so I would ask people to temper their amazement just a little bit at Greg Abbott, because we all came out, most of us, with good attitudes from the hospital after our injuries. We all have the same thing that you have, Chris, and your guest there is a human spirit that it's hard to crush. I mean, it's just amazing what we can go through and come out and feel good about ourselves. So I wouldn't be too amazed by Mr. Abbott. After all, $11 million will free someone up to be able to take just about any kind of job and be happy with it. He can actually afford to be a conservative. If I had $11 million, I could afford to be a conservative. But
well, Martin, I think those points are well taken, and I really appreciate your perspective. Thank you so much for calling. Is there anything you wanted to say to that, Brian? I mean, would Greg Abbott say the same thing? Don't be too amazed by me.
Yeah, I think that that's probably true. And I agree with the caller. I think that those are very, very smart points. Certainly anybody in that situation to realize how fundamentally your life is going to change and what that means in terms of going forward, it's hard for me to even imagine that. I think that in his case, it certainly did refocus his energies. I think that's a reasonable point, that a settlement that large is obviously going to help solve some aspects of it. But as he has said, I will give back every penny of that settlement if I could walk, if I could dance with my wife, or if I could walk my daughter down the aisle. Now, again, I think that anybody in that situation would agree to that. I think the thing that strikes me is that as a result of the accident, I think that General Abbott became a much harder and tougher individual. And by that, I mean, I think that he has tremendous empathy for those people who are struggling. In fact, I think what you're going to hear from him is that because he has overcome this thing, you too as a Texan can overcome the things in your life, whether they're physical, but if they're social, if they're economic, if there's something in your family history, that if you work hard, that you can conquer these things and that you too can achieve what it is that you set out to achieve. The flip side to that is, and he had told me that, you know, he spent 6 months in rehabilitation on his back before they put on what they call a body jacket, which essentially held his frame upright. He referred to it as his turtle shell, and that he actually went to work at Butler and Binion with the turtle shell on. He wasn't even able to put a suit jacket on, but he went to work. And one of the interesting things that he told me was that, you know, he had the sense that his bosses loved it, that the partners loved it, because if there were other lawyers who thought, I can't finish a project in time, I'm not ready for this particular case, or something along those lines, you could look over at Greg Abbott and say, well, he's doing it, so, you know, you might as well get back to work. And I think that there is a level of toughness to him that comes from having achieved this thing. He's empathetic to people who are struggling, but I also think that he believes that people can overcome it if they set their minds to it. But the reader's point, I'm sorry, the caller's point is very well taken in terms of that settlement. And I think that is something that will continue to be an issue on the campaign trail going forward.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Let's speak next with Marvin in West. Hello, Marvin.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I'd just like to tell you, I had a personal experience with General Abbott, and I've got nothing but high praise for him. I had an issue with child support. After the child support was done, I voluntarily paid before any order, and then after the children were grown, they showed me being in arrears because they didn't have, prior to the order, didn't show where the money had come from. And it took a paper from my ex-wife signing to get this cleared, and she refused to sign it. This was an amount of about $1,200, but they were going to seize my income tax return because of it.
You know, Marvin, I totally understand the gravity of the situation. If you wouldn't mind, just for the sake of our audience, kind of fast-forwarding to how General Abbott was involved in this.
Well, I called the Attorney General's office, and he personally answered the phone. Hmm. And I explained the situation, and he had me fax him the receipts. And in a matter of an hour and a half, he called me back personally and told me that this was taken care of, sent a letter showing that it was, and took care of it with the IRS. He's a man that does what he sets out to do. He's got an extremely terrific work ethic and an honesty to him that's unusual nowadays.
It's a great story, Marvin. Thank you so much. Is that the sort of thing,
Marvin,
that you heard from other people as well?
Generally speaking, yes. That constituent services as part of the Attorney General's office has been one of the high marks of his tenure. I'm not going to say that that's the case in all cases, certainly, and I have no doubt that people have their concerns about it. One thing that I noticed within the staff, for example, is that he has a core level of senior staff who have been with him a very, very long time, many of whom have been with him even before he ran for Attorney General or just as he was getting ready to run. And so as I spoke to lawyers across the state, and I spoke to many in Dallas and Houston and in other parts, there was the sense that, again, even if they agreed or didn't agree with his politics, that there was a level of loyalty and competency at the Attorney General's office that they all remarked on.
So, I mean, by definition, politicians have to make a great number of friends. They also, can't help but make some enemies. Can you talk about, first of all, within his own party, what concerns there might be about his position of leadership within the party in Texas?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, in part because the situation has become very, very fluid. I mean, as we have seen the rise of the Tea Party, particularly in the state of Texas, the Republican Party has begun to change, and it has changed in a way that has pushed it farther to the right, and that we have seen many statewide candidates or candidates for statewide office really make sure that they have their flank covered. You know, the textbook case study that students will look at now going forward for the rest of their lives will be the race in which Ted Cruz challenged Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst for the U.S. Senate seat. That looked like an absolute lock for the lieutenant governor, and as we all know, that didn't turn out that way. The thing that I would say that's very interesting is that in this cycle that we have coming up in 2014, now that Governor Rick Perry has announced that he is not running, and he was absolutely the cork in the bottle. Politicians do many, many things well, but one of the things that they do is they all run up, right? Mm-hmm. They're all looking to climb the ladder. And so with Governor Perry sitting at the top, he has essentially held that leadership in place. Look at how long General Abbott has been Attorney General. Look at how long Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst has been in office. Now we have this absolute frenzy of, all of these races having opened up. In fact, the major statewide races are all right now open seats, except for the lieutenant governor's race, which certainly feels like an open seat. And as a result of that, you have had this mad scramble. Where have you not had a mad scramble? At the very top of the ticket, at what most people would consider one of the most powerful and prominent spots in state politics, if not something to put you on the national stage, and that is to be governor of Texas. Right now, General Abbott is facing only one Republican primary candidate, opponent, and that is former state party chair and workforce commission chairman Tom Paukin, who is an underfunded candidate. I did an interview with him a couple of weeks ago that I headlined The Underdog. And I think it's very clear that General Abbott has the opportunity to really run away in that race. Whereas you look down ballot and you see so many people in the race for lieutenant governor, so many people in the race for attorney general, so many people in the race for comptroller. And I think that probably says more than anything else about how the party is feeling about General Abbott. We certainly didn't, you know, weren't the ones to make the case that he was a lock for governor, or that he was the, you know, the heir apparent to Rick Perry. That is the way the political landscape has played out. And I think that was the impetus for writing this story. Who is this man that we expect will be the next governor and serve for who knows how many terms when only 51% of Texans in a recent poll had no opinion of him?
Why does he want to be governor?
I think that's an excellent question. I mean, I think that gets to the core of part of his personality, which as a result, I think, of the accident has been one of achieving things. You know, you achieve one thing and then you move on to achieve the next thing. I think that there is also a level of people have been bottled up now for all of these years because of Governor Perry. And so once it opened up, you could be sure that people were going to be angling for the seats that they thought that they had the biggest chance at. And beyond that, I think that he, and probably the most substantive reason, I think beyond that is I think he believes that he can extend the conservative brand in Texas in a way that helps solidify the party's control. Now, that may seem like a crazy thing to say. Democrat hasn't won statewide office in Texas since 1994. But we are at a time of huge impending demographic change. Believe it or not, there is a faint heartbeat in the statewide Democratic Party. And so I think when you put all of those things together, the question that comes out of it is, would General Abbott lead Texas essentially become an extension of the Perry years, or would he introduce his own brand of conservatism? And I think he believes he is the person to go forward. I think part of that, he says, is because he has overcome the accident. I think part of it is because he is married to his longtime wife, Cecilia, who is Hispanic. Her grandparents were immigrated from Mexico and settled in San Antonio and didn't speak English when they came over here. And I think his notion is that his family represents a blending that is happening all across Texas. And as a result of that, he understands what the future of Texas is and is able to tap into that.
Brian Sweeney is with us. He is senior executive editor at Texas Monthly Magazine and author of the October cover story about Attorney General Greg Abbott, The Overcomer. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'll be taking more of your calls after the break. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Brian Sweeney, who is senior executive editor for Texas Monthly Magazine and who wrote Texas Monthly's cover story for its October issue. It's about Attorney General and Texas gubernatorial candidate Greg Abbott. The article is called The Overcomer. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now and this time speak with Karen in Dallas. Hello, Karen.
Hi. I want to know how General Abbott works through the hypocrisy of talking about his rehabilitation and recovery from injury and then being against the Affordable Care Act or expansion of Medicaid so that other young people who have the exact same injury would have no access to care.
Did you talk to him about anything like that, Brian?
We actually didn't talk specifically about Obamacare, which is used both by Republicans and Democrats. I think that it's a good question for sure. I think what he would say is that there are other mechanisms that are out there that people could take advantage of. But I think, again, it's going to be the type of thing that opens him up to a very specific line of attack for those people who feel that as a result of the accident and the things that he has done, based on some of his public statements, as the caller has said about the ACA or about the Americans with Disabilities Act or other things, that that he is a hypocrite on some of those issues. That is something that will unfold as the campaign continues, assuming that State Senator Wendy Davis does in fact declare this week for governor. I have no doubt that we will have a far more robust discussion on the campaign trail than we have had about any of these issues prior to this, in part because Abbott has not faced, you know, stiff competition for his job since the 2002 race. And again, I think it's something that he will have to be prepared to answer.
There is a great deal of excitement within the Democratic Party about the potential candidacy of State Senator Wendy Davis, but she would still, am I correct, just based on demographics in Texas, have an uphill battle to even hope to beat Greg Abbott?
Well, I think that, yes. I mean, my sense is that it is important, if I put on my political consultant hat, of which I'm not a very good one, but if I put it on, I would say that, one, the Democrats have no chance of winning if they don't field any players. Mm-hmm. And as of right now, as I say, you have so many Republicans in all of these major races ready to just sort of duke it out. And the Democrats have waited. And talking to various Democrats, it does seem to me that there is some confusion as to what their strategy should be. Should we go in 14? Should we wait for 18? Do we want to put some A-list people out there? You know, how do we do it? The thing that I would say about a potential candidacy by Senator Davis is this. Walk back in your recent memory as to when you can think that the Democratic base would have a nominee that they were truly excited about. And I have to say, and in all respect, it's not Bill White, and it's not Chris Bell, and it's not Tony Sanchez, and it's not Gary Morrow. I mean, I think you literally have to go all the way back to the 1990 race with Ann Richards when she first ran to see any sort of sense of that level of excitement that people got behind a charismatic figure, you know, somebody who was sort of willing to kind of come out and make the case. So that is a huge advantage for Senator Davis, that she has name ID and money coming in. But as you say, Texas is a Republican state. Not only that, it is a conservative state. And when you look at the voting totals over the last rounds of races, Romney versus Obama, Ted Cruz versus Paul Sadler, go back to 2010, Rick Perry versus Bill White, you're looking somewhere in the neighborhood of a built-in 15-point spread that the Democrats have to close the gap. That is a huge number. That is an unbelievably huge number. But I think that if the Democrats are going to begin to tilt the state back to in their direction, they have to do it by getting out there first and foremost and playing the game and running a full slate of candidates. So I think that it's not just Senator Davis, assuming that she does go, and I think that she will go. It's who comes in behind her, who runs for lieutenant governor, who runs for attorney general, who runs for comptroller. You have to have all of those pieces for the Democrats to be considered a credible statewide force. And as of late, I mean, I think that you could make the case that they quite simply are not. That's not a partisan statement on my part. That's just sizing up the field. Again, no Democrat has won statewide office in Texas since 1994. That's the longest stretch of any state in the country right now.
Well, interestingly, you say the most explosive issue Abbott faces is over voting. Can you talk about his actions with regard to voter ID laws, redistricting, and that sort of thing?
Well, so this is, I think, very, very interesting, because on the one hand, you have the Republican Party trying to work now very, very hard to reach Hispanic voters who a lot of people will say, well, naturally, they tend to vote Democratic. The Republican Party says not so fast. The current state party chair, Steve Ministeri, has made this very, very clear that he wants to be as aggressive of courting new Hispanic voters as the Democrats have been. What's interesting, though, is that the fight over the redistricting maps, which began in the 2011 legislative session and have been hung up in the courts ever since then, and also over voter ID, have been two very, very painful partisan issues that really have driven a sharp wedge between Democrats and Republicans. And if Senator Davis does run, and assuming that General Abbott does win the Republican primary against Tom Paulken, if that becomes the dynamic, I think that you're going to hear an awful lot from the Democrats about fairness to voters, about reaching out to new segments of the voting population, and asking questions about why is there this perceived harshness on the Republican side in terms of drawing maps that are fair and trying to limit turnout at polling places through voter ID. Now, Republicans say that's absolutely not correct. General Abbott will say that, in fact, Hispanics, by and large, actually favor voter ID. But it does become a very powerful issue, in part because it is still hung up in the courts. And one of the things that had happened with the 2011 maps, this last round that is still undergoing litigation, is that a panel in D.C. had found intentional discrimination, which is to say that the maps were effectively, in this one particular instance, drawn to minimize minority effect. Well, we hadn't had a ruling like that since the early 70s, so it's been a long time since we've seen something. Maps have been rejected, and to be fair, they had been rejected under both Democratic and Republican administrations. But I think that this could become an issue that the Democrats have a little bit of traction on, in part because it's unresolved, and in part because people feel very, very strongly about it, particularly as you're trying to address Hispanic turnout.
Brian, do you know who is on board to advise Abbott's campaign at this stage? And is there any lesson we can take from his choice of staff?
Well, he certainly has a deep staff. I mean, his main political consultant is a name that will be also be familiar to your listeners, and that's Dave Carney. There are a lot of people who had come over from the Rick Perry campaign. Dave had run Rick Perry's presidential campaign and had been involved in other statewide campaigns. And so he is one of the people who is heading it up. And it does sort of beg this question that if you wonder if General Abbott intends to take conservatism in a new direction or extend the Perry years, one of the things I think that you do is sort of parse the relationship between the two of them. And for example, I found it interesting that in his speech in San Antonio when he made his formal announcement, Perry's name didn't come up a single time. Hmm. And so I think there's also this notion on Abbott's side that he wants to make sure that he is his own man, but I also think that he wants to distance himself from the baggage that Perry brings. Having been here for so long, even among conservatives, obviously Perry has certainly made his fair share of political enemies. But I think there's also a level of Perry fatigue in the state, even among conservatives. And I think Abbott has tried to position himself in just the right way. That's one of the things that I had heard from a lot of folks is just how professional the Abbott campaigns are, that they are typically mistake-free. Now, we've seen a few things. I mentioned Dave Carney's name. You know, he is the one that had sent out that tweet essentially linking to a story and saying in parentheses why Wendy Davis is not smart enough to be governor. I would imagine that from Wendy Davis's camp, they should keep doing that, right? I mean, I think that would be the one thing that Senator Davis would hope for is they continue to make foolish mistakes like that, that anger women, that demean the opponent, and really sort of take the focus off of the politics and policy that are in play here. So that was a mistake. And it's one of those things that I think that you cannot assume that this is all said and done, even though, as you say, we have jokingly done so on our cover. But I think back to that 1990 race between Ann Richards and Clayton Williams. Clayton Williams was way out in front of Richards, and he made a couple of serious mistakes along the way that really turned voters, particularly female voters, against him and helped win the governor's mansion for Ann Richards.
Any doubt in your mind that if the nominees are Greg Abbott and Wendy Davis, that those two will meet and debate?
No, I can't imagine that that's the case. I do hope that as the Republican field firms up, I hope that General Abbott will debate Tom Paulken. I mean, I think that's the one thing that we have had as a result of this, the emergence of social media and how unbelievably engaged people can now be in these campaigns. I think that it is inexcusable for major party candidates not to debate the issues in public, in front of an audience, with an opportunity for people to engage. That has now become the norm. It should be the norm. And I think that it just, quite frankly, it should be done. Now, there's a case where I think that Senator Davis will certainly be the one saying, let's debate today, tomorrow, the next day, the day after that, and every day until, you know, the election. I suspect General Abbott will be the one, his campaign will probably want to set some parameters and the dates on it. But no, I don't have any date that they will debate as they should.
Any big differences, do you think, in how the candidates will spend the money they have, the particular cities and markets that they will focus their advertising efforts on?
That's a terrific question. I mean, we know by and large that rural Texas now is conservative Texas, East Texas is conservative Texas, and so I would imagine, again, I'll put on my political consultant hat, which doesn't fit me very well, I would imagine that Senator Davis is going to spend most of her dollars on outreach in the urban counties and in the big cities. She will be able to raise a lot of money, but of course, the Abbott apparatus and having already been out on the campaign trail, keep in mind, we're talking about a candidate in Senator Davis who hasn't even announced yet. He has been out on the campaign trail. Part of the reason why I think other Republicans did not run against him is that this apparatus had been in place, which is to say, behind the scenes or otherwise, he had been building the infrastructure needed to make a run for the governor's mansion. So she will be playing catch up. And she will, again, be playing catch up at a point where I think that there's 13 to 15 points separating them solely because one is the Republican and one is the Democrat. That is a huge margin to overcome. So I think that the best thing that Senator Davis can do is, and we saw this in an interview that she did at the Texas Tribune Festival on Sunday, you know, she began to stake out positions that messaged in a way what it means to be a Democrat in Texas today. And so women's health and abortion politics were kept at a minimum. You know, she was talking about infrastructure. She was talking about taxes. She was talking about the suit with American Airlines and the merger with American Airlines, where incidentally she came out on the side of the Texas Association of Business and the Chambers of Commerce in Dallas and Fort Worth. Sort of give her a pro-business record. I think that's where she can begin to make inroads to close that gap. But it is a very, very difficult race. And one, quite frankly, that I think that is nearly insurmountable unless certain things break her way, not the least of which would be some large-scale mistakes by the Abbott campaign.
Well, does that, what did you say, 15-point spread between the two starting out? I mean, does that make, ideally, would Greg Abbott simply play it really conservatively, knowing that the race is his to lose?
Yes, I think that's exactly what, that's what any smart political consultant would be telling him, and I think that's exactly what he's doing. You know, I'm thinking back on some of these numbers, and, you know, Senator Cruz in the 2012 cycle, he beat Paul Sadler for that race by about 15 points, 15 and a half points. Governor Perry beat Bill White in the 2010 race somewhere in the neighborhood of 13 points. And so those are pretty stable numbers once you get to the general election. One of the things that I noticed with my reporting with General Abbott is that, you know, he was not one to go off into the very specific details of what he would, how he would solve certain problems as governor. One of the things that I had asked him, in fact, was, which previous governor do you admire, or which governor solved a problem in a way that you think was the right way to go? And, you know, there are a lot of easy examples that you can throw out. You can throw out John Connolly with higher education. You can throw out Alan Shivers with the Tidelands. Dan Moody with the Klan. That happened before he was governor, but that's one of the things that he's famous for. And very interestingly enough, General Abbott didn't take the bait. He didn't want to talk specifically about any previous governors. And what he told me was that he believed that his administration would be unique in part because of who he is and what he had been through. And that, I thought, was a really interesting window on how he sees himself and how he sees his political career going forward.
Brian Sweeney is senior executive editor at Texas Monthly Magazine. He wrote the cover story about Texas Attorney General Greg Abbott for the October issue. The article is called The Overcomer. Brian joined us today from the studios of KUT in Austin. Brian Sweeney, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the show. My name is Chris Boyd. Have a great day.